This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Seattle apparently appears to be poised to change the single-family zoning that has made it so difficult to build affordable housing. And Tim Parham is here from the Seattle Planning Commission. And let's begin by explaining to people what the Planning Commission does.
Yeah, the Planning Commission is an advisory group to City Council and the mayor. We're a 16-member body of citizens of Seattle, just like everybody else. We just happen to be experts in areas like public health, planning, land use, architecture, development, and that sort of thing.
What's your area of expertise?
So I'm an affordable housing developer.
Mm-hmm. So you actually have built housing before, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
When you look at that map that shows that the vast bulk of Seattle's landmass is single-family zoning, does that strike you as odd for a city this size?
It does, and it's not something that we're going through alone. There was a panel on Tuesday night where we had a planner from Portland and Vancouver. So it's something that other big cities in the region are facing as well, is how do we continue to grow equitably? How do we continue to not focus all our growth into big apartment buildings, essentially, and how do we look at those large swaths of land that have all the great parks and schools and allow more people to have access to those places.
When you say grow equitably, what do you mean by that?
We've done a really good job of accommodating the rapid population growth. I think there's questions about how equitable that growth has been. We've seen 80% of our population growth in the last 10 to 12 years happen in the city's urban villages.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly all the public schools and parks in our city are located in almost three quarters of our land area that's in single family zoned areas.
I see. So the public amenities are actually being limited to a relatively small portion of the population.
Yeah. Yeah. So the types of ideas that we talk about in our report are just incremental changes. We're not talking about glass towers in Magnolia or Laurelhurst. We're talking about the same bulk and scale of buildings that you're seeing today relatively, mm-hmm, that will accommodate just more people in the same size housing.
My guess is that one of the findings of your report is going to be a talk show topic, because it says single family neighborhoods mostly accommodate a certain type of person, namely high income and white residents. Why did you put race? Why did you mention race as part of this?
I guess I'd ask, how could we not? You know, Richard Rothstein, who just wrote the book Color of Law, was just in town, who laid out a really clear argument for why the systems, both from the federal government to the city government, have put in policies in place that sort of predicted this sort of segregation that we have, not just in Seattle, but in many cities across the country today. And it's true that there are disproportionate across racial lines income levels. And we feel like the changes we're proposing in the report really talk about a way to increase affordability without income restriction, smaller scale units that maybe have different price points that might be affordable to a different variety of people at different incomes, but also across different races. And if you look at the demographics of many of the neighborhoods that we're talking about, they are predominantly higher income and they are white. So those are the facts. I'm not, mm-hmm, it's not meant to be polarizing. We recognize that this could be anxiety.
It's not meant to be polarizing. Yeah. It sort of implies that if those single family neighborhoods had been, let's say, 50% black, then they would need to be rezoned.
I don't know that I would jump to that conclusion. I think there's other areas of our city that are more racially diverse, like the central area,
mm-hmm,
has similar amounts of single family zoning that need to be explored.
Mm-hmm. I believe that in those areas where there are predominantly black populations, they don't call it rezoning. They call it gentrification. They call it driving out the people who settled that area.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that question up, Dave. We talk a lot about in a report how to deal with displacement. The pressures people are feeling today is just, you know, are multiple. There's not one solution to combat the displacement that's happening in Seattle. But we feel like there's really not any one strategy in these single family zoned areas. One potential idea we explore in a report is allowing people to stay in place as their property taxes triple and double over the years. And, you know, maybe they're retired and on a fixed income. What if they were allowed to sell their backyard to a developer instead of having to sell their whole property and leave Seattle? At the same time, we recognize that, you know, this sort of economic displacement needs other strategies. Those folks that I'm talking about in that hypothetical scenario, they need the resources from the city to learn how to do that. You know, a lot of us aren't scaled that real estate development, or don't know what to do when a broker sends them a flyer that says, hey, I'm going to offer you a lot of money for your house. Can the city provide technical resources to help people figure out how to stay in place?
I mean, you must be conscious of the disparate impact of zoning, because in a white neighborhood where people tend to own their homes, they get rich. In a more diverse neighborhood where people are probably mostly rentals, they get kicked out, and it's the property owner who rented the house to them that gets rich.
Right. That's exactly the thing that we're pointing to, why this is a race and equity issue. That said, we also don't think it's that radical. We recognize some of the points you've made earlier about this could be uncomfortable or cause anxiety for some folks. But when you're talking about just the buildings, we're talking about the same relative scale that you're already seeing happen. Mm-hmm. Folks are already tearing down historic old Craftsman and building three-story massive houses. And you know how many people those are accommodating? Two.
Yeah.
Two or three.
Because family sizes are dropping.
Yeah,
even though the houses are
and
large.
That's already happening. So if that's your concern about neighborhood character and scale, I think that's a sort of a misnomer. That's a false argument, because that's already happening. Why don't we just accommodate more folks in mm-hmm. that same scale, and at the same time address some of your concerns about design?
All right. So what kind of zoning changes are you recommending, and which neighborhoods are going to be affected by this, Tim?
So as I said at the beginning, we're an advisory group. We're like the Kickstarters of ideas. We hope that council and the mayor, we've met with all of them and talked to them about our ideas. We hope, and thank you for having me on, we hope that people keep starting this conversation. You know, we don't have any specific proposals. Mm-hmm. We'll work with, you know, the elected officials as they mm-hmm. develop.
So you haven't chosen neighborhoods at this stage?
Even if we proposed neighborhoods in our report, I mean, it's really up to the elected officials mm-hmm. and their staff to mm-hmm. to figure all that out.
But you deliberately want to open the Pandora's box by saying we have to start rezoning some of these single family neighborhoods and even allowing development in backyards, which is an interesting idea. So you would allow a homeowner to say, I want to stay in my home, but go ahead and build a 5-story building in my backyard?
Yeah, or one of the other ideas is to maybe limit the allowable size that you could build in a single family area, unless you're providing for more than one household to live in your new structure.
Oh, actually saying you can still have your single family lot, but it better be a small house?
It either better be a moderately sized house mm-hmm. or accommodate more than just one single family, which is what our current zoning does. And that's not always the way Seattle has done it. You look at in the 1920s, there's many sort of streetcar suburbs like Wallingford and mm-hmm. Fremont that you walk around and there's these, the technical term is non-conforming uses. There's duplexes and triplexes and townhomes. Why don't we have more of that? It's because we outlawed it in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so this isn't new. It's just we haven't done it in a long time. And the city grew that way at one time until the 50s, 60s, and 70s when we started to have minimum lot sizes for single family areas.
Tim Barham, Seattle Planning Commission. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Dave.
Washington State is on track to have some of the toughest gun laws in the nation. It's being considered by the legislature now, and it's being pushed by a gun safety group. Curator's Hannah Scott is here. So toughest in the nation, huh? Like what? What new laws are we about
to
see?
All of the ones in 1639 already will put us, I believe it's 5th or 10th in the nation as far as what our gun laws would be mm-hmm. after.
But this is going to be added on to that?
This is a new agenda. Every year, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility comes out with their legislative agenda that turns into bills that we see in Olympia. This year, they're out with a very aggressive agenda.
This is the most robust agenda we've ever proposed. Usually we have a few little policies here and there that we're looking to pass. This agenda includes about 14 items, I believe.
So among those items, we're talking about restrictions.
Who is that, by the way?
That is, I'm sorry, Tallman Trask with the Alliance for Gun Responsibility.
Okay.
So among those 14 items, we've got new restrictions on high-capacity magazines. So State Attorney General Bob Ferguson has put out several bills, I want to say at least over the last 3 years, there's been three different ones that have failed, that are full bans on high-capacity magazines, which, again, are detachable magazines that hold 10 or more rounds.
10 or more, okay.
Yeah. And those have failed. They're working on the bill language still. He doesn't think it will be an all-out ban, but it would be somehow further restricting those type of magazines. Now, another one we've seen before, a bill in Olympia, this one targets state preemption law, which, again, is what prohibits local jurisdictions from enacting their own gun restrictions.
Specifically looking at ways to make sure that municipalities and localities have ways to restrict sort of either the open carry or ease of access to firearms and particularly sort of volatile or potentially volatile situations. That's not a full removal of preemption that's been proposed in the past, I believe. But it's more of a targeted way to make sure that law enforcement and cities have the tools that they need.
Okay, now is that controversial?
Yes.
Okay, and my question, though, now is why? Because what I'm hearing from the gun rights people is we don't want the cities imposing restrictions on rural areas. But now, the way things are now because of preemption, in order for Seattle to get what it wants, it has to go to the state, which would be Seattle, which has the most, you know, concentrated population, imposing stuff on rural areas. If you got rid of preemption, then rural areas could have the rules that best suit them, and the cities could have the rules that best suit them. What's wrong with that?
Gun rights advocates are absolutely firmly against the undoing of the state preemption law. Among the other things that they are critical about is that it's not fair for a gun owner to travel, you know, from one city to the next and not know what
that.
A lot. I mean, a lot. I mean, there are a lot of concealed carry.
But there's no border wall, right? There's no border wall where they're going to screen you for guns. Could you have a compromise where the state passes, you know, a rural area could, for example, have, if it approves, less restrictive gun laws than statewide, if that suits them, so they can, you know, shoot varmints and go hunting and stuff
and
like
all of that.
That.
But that person from the rural area, they have business in Seattle that day. They have an open carry permit. They drive into Seattle, walk around in a park. They don't know that Seattle has that law, and now they're on the hook.
Maybe they got to lock their gun up in the car then, just for
that
trip.
But how do they know?
And if they're going to Seattle all the time, then they're not really a rural resident, are they? They're a commuter then.
Anyway, that is the argument, that it could be various different cities. Another one we're looking at here is a suicide prevention measure is what they call it, and that this would deal with temporarily removing gun rights of people under short involuntary commitments.
Temporarily restrict access to people who have been held for 72 hours under a mental health hold, and this wouldn't be the sort of kind of permanent restriction we see with felonies or things like that. It would be a 6-month temporary restriction just to make sure that people can get through periods of crisis. And this would specifically be for people who are at risk of suicide in particular.
So, and I think that's a healthy bill. Already that happens when we're talking about a 14-day. Yeah. So this is kind of closing that loophole.
Expanding the extreme risk protection orders. Tell me about that. To include hate crimes?
Yes, absolutely. And wow. I heard some discussion about this before. This would be a bill that would allow you to include threats that show up either on social media or bigoted type comments, threatening hate behavior. Again, because we've seen
If you tweeted some stuff like Kevin Hart tweets, for example, would they disarm him?
Again, this is the particulars aren't worked out on this, but that's what the bill will eventually look like. So you're going to have to get, they're going to have to be very specific about what's going to
be
under.
Dicey.
It'll be dicey. They're going to have to be careful about the way this is worded, but it's on the agenda. That's what they want. I suspect we'll see a bill in Olympia carefully worded for what will be addressed in this.
And a reminder, Democrats control everything.
Yeah, so overall, the Alliance for Gun Responsibility, they endorse multiple candidates, both in the state and in the national level. All in all told, as far as who they wanted reelected and newly elected, 84% of those they backed got it done. So they're very confident they can get at least some, if not all of these, through. Wow. In Olympia. Dave Workman over at the GunMag.com, Second Amendment Foundation, he's concerned.
I think this proves that their ultimate goal is to prohibit private firearms ownership incrementally.
I asked Solomon about that. There's this big thing from the gun rights folks that there's been this slippery slope, right, since 594 that's going to ultimately lead to confiscation. Alliance for Gun Responsibility says that's just not the case, that's just, you know, the boogeyman, basically, is what they say.
Anna Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
One of the big concerns in the financial world has been our trade war with China, and the arrest of a top Chinese executive isn't helping matters. The chief financial officer of Huawei, a huge telecom company, is now in custody and could be extradited to the U.S., arrested by the Canadian government at our request. We still don't have a definitive reason for the arrest, however. We called up Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation, who's been covering the story.
There have been concerns for some time among U.S. officials that this smartphone maker, which surpassed Apple as the biggest seller of those kinds of equipment and devices, that perhaps they are working with, since they are invested in by the Chinese government, in spying. But this arrest specifically of the CFO is related to sanctions violations. So it's not clear that it's the intellectual property theft and espionage that motivated the Justice Department to act finally. But what we do know, and as you rightly point out, the markets have been rattled because this company is so huge. It has such a big imprint. And this is such an unprecedented action by the Trump administration to seek the extradition of an executive. That's something they do for arms dealers, drug dealers, not for CFOs, that this could signal a new front in the trade war. The White House, however, insists that its trade dispute with China has nothing to do with this action to arrest the CFO, but it certainly has drawn some skepticism from Beijing, along with demands for her immediate release. So this is not a signal that trust or trade agreements are on the up and up right now. It's actually a sign of concern for many.
I'm reading this morning that the president was not told about this and didn't know about it when he tweeted about the deal he had reached with the president of China. Is that indeed the case?
The White House is insisting that neither the president nor his top national security advisor, John Bolton, knew about the arrest at the time they sat down with China's leader, Xi Jinping. Remember, this was on Saturday at the G20, and it is extraordinary that this arrest took place at the very same time that the two leaders were meeting. What's also an incredible coincidence is that at the heart of the president's trade strategy is trying to maintain U.S. dominance in technology. So for the White House to say one had nothing to do with the other has drawn some skepticism from Beijing, who has a hard time understanding what the White House insists is a division between the executive and the Justice Department, that this was a criminal action, that they were taking action to enforce U.S. law and not using it as leverage in trade negotiations. So the explanation has gotten a bit muddied here, but the White House says this wasn't all a coordinated action.
Pure speculation on my part, but is it possible that law enforcement officials purposely did not inform the president for fear that he might order them to cancel the arrest for fear that it might indeed spook the trade deal with China?
Well, the Justice Department and the White House insist that one did not inform the other at the highest levels because that's not how it's supposed to happen. Law enforcement is supposed to enforce the law and do so without political interference. So that is why they are insisting very strongly here that the Justice Department was going about its business in an apolitical way. Canadian officials also came out and said the same thing. In fact, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said it was law enforcement who knew about this in advance, but that he didn't have any political interference here. The bottom line, though, is no matter who you believe, this is an extraordinary action to arrest and potentially extradite one of the top executives of one of China's telecom firms, one of the biggest companies in the world, and to do so at a time when there's already a lot of nervousness that things are only going to get more tense between the world's two largest economies.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Time for movie man Michael Medved and a review of the latest retelling of The Jungle Book, a movie called Mowgli. And this is not a Disney film.
It is not a Disney film, but it is a big star-studded attraction with lots of big names. Benedict Cumberbatch provides his voice here as Shere Khan the Tiger. Christian Bale, Oscar winner, of course, provides his voice as Bagheera the Panther. And then you have Andy Serkis directing this, known as Gollum. And he also plays the voice of Baloo the Bear. Cate Blanchett, yet another Oscar winner, is Ka the Python. And the whole thing is very ambitious. It's great looking. And you scratch your head and you ask, why? I don't know who this film is made for. That's the basic problem. Now, by the way, for people who don't know the story, this has almost no connection. It's not recognizable from the cartoon Disney version. It's a little bit recognizable from the live-action Disney version, which, of course, is much closer to the Rudyard Kipling original from 100 years ago. But it's very dark. It's disturbing, actually. People have called it a blood-soaked reimagining.
What's the story?
Well, the story basically is a boy is orphaned in the edges of the Indian jungle at an indeterminate time. It seems to be set about at the turn of the century, close to the time that the original Jungle Book stories were written by Rudyard Kipling Nobel Prize winner. You've got Oscar winners, Nobel Prize winners. And the boy is orphaned. He is rescued by a panther, and again, voiced by Christian Bale. He brings the boy to a pack of wolves, who then raise him as part of the pack. And the film, I think, is trying to be sort of an adolescent coming-of-age movie where he doesn't really fit into the pack. He's not really a wolf, even though he tries to assert that he is. And yet he doesn't fit in with human beings. He's later taken to human captivity and actually kept in a cage. But basically, the plot of the movie is the evil tiger who killed the boy's mother now wants to kill him, to finish, to taste his blood. And he is...
That's pretty dark.
It's fairly dark.
Now, is that from the original or not?
Yeah, there are elements like that in the original. Mm-hmm. I think the connection with the tiger being very specific, wanting the mm-hmm. taste of the boy, I think that's...
Well, maybe that's the point, though, to stop sugarcoating the originals like Disney does.
Right. And I think that is the point. Yeah. But then you're left with, why do you want to see this movie?
The book must have some merit because it's...
No, the book
so
has great merit. Yeah. But the book asks you to use your imagination. And this film, by the way, the good parts of it is, as a technical achievement, it's impressive. There are beautiful shots. The camera work is great. Andy Serkis, I think, gets pretty good performances from his people. But the problem is that the boy playing Mowgli is a great screen presence, but the acting on the part of this young man, whose name is Chand Rohan, is way over the top. And there are some scenes that are just cringeworthy.
Really?
Yeah.
Acting in front of a green screen, I assume, right?
Yeah, it's all for animated. Most of it, sure. Yeah. And again, I'm sure maybe he'll go on to better things as he grows up. But it's hard for me to imagine someone going to this version of The Jungle Book. And even if you haven't seen the previous animated version and the most recent Disney live-action film, which was quite striking and very good and very successful, I think it's tough to see this film and not feel deeply disappointed. I did not see the 3D version, mm-hmm. But apparently the 3D is very striking and visually is very striking, which is why it can be awarded 2 stars, but certainly no more than that. And by the way, it's rated PG-13. Let me just put it this way. One of the scenes involves one of his best friends in the animal world, who he later encounters stuffed. And it's an extremely creepy scene.
So you're saying not a Christmas movie, huh?
Unless you want to try to assure or educate your young viewers about how nature is red and tooth and claw, mm-hmm. it's a tough movie.
2 stars, Mowgli. Michael Medved, thank you.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. We have a new top layaway angel, someone who paid off $430,000 worth of layaways at 2 Atlanta Walmarts. 1,487 people received news that their layaway angel is actor and filmmaker Tyler Perry.
My best friend called me, she's like, Tyler Perry paid for your layaway. I'm like, what?
I called Walmart and they were like, it's true. So I was crying actually to a man on the Walmart.
He got on Twitter after news broke that he was a layaway angel last night to reveal some reasons why he did it.
I was trying to do this anonymously, but due to some circumstances, y'all know how nothing stays secret these days. I have paid for all of your layaways for Christmas. I know it's hard times. A lot of people are struggling. I'm just really, really grateful to be able to be in a position to do this.
He says he was inspired by stories he's seen on the news this season of other layaway angels. So he went for it.
Who just does that? So, Mr. Perry, you are amazing. And I personally thank you. My associates thank you. And I know the community thank you.
God bless you. Go get your stuff. Merry Christmas.
And here's the thing. You don't have to have $430,000 to be a layaway angel. I'm reminded that it is our holiday magic time of year where we're raising money mm-hmm. for Treehouse for foster kids in our state. So you just have to text the word magic to 98973 to find out how you can help foster kids this Christmas season.
Treehouse, a great program.
Now it's time for a Sports Insider and his dog, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill.
With dog Peaches. Is that
a Peach? Oh, she's Peach. She's singular.
Peach?
Yeah, came over here from Korea. Don't tell Trump, though. She got in.
One of those wrinkly-faced breeds.
Yeah, she's a Chinese guard dog from Korea.
Oh, like the ones that guard the libraries and everything?
I think that's what initially they were. At one point, they were endangered. They were down to like 16 of them, and they published them on the cover of Life magazine back in the 50s or 60s.
Aww.
Yeah, what's and they made a comeback.
What's on your Christmas reading list, Peach?
Yeah, Peach can't read. She's pretty blind.
I see. Okay.
She didn't get her eye surgery in time.
Oh, well.
Her entropion.
Oh, well. So tell me about the shoe-throwing incident. The
Russell Wilson? Game. You're not a pet guy, are you, Dave? Dave faked it very well. Dave faked it very well.
But I've learned to ask people about their dog.
That's right. It's like this social cue that he's picked up on.
Yeah. We're going to ask you about your new granddaughter. You can ask us about our pets, right?
Congratulations about that.
Thank you very much.
Yes, so a player, Fred Warner, who is a rookie linebacker from the San Francisco 49ers, he came out of his shoe. There's a shoe laying around. Russell Wilson goes to start the next play. This is in the third quarter, and he sees a shoe. And he takes the shoe, and he threw it over toward the 49ers sidelines. The Seahawks snapped their play. The guy has to run on late to replace Warner. The 49ers aren't set at all. And Kyle Shanahan loses his mind. Most people will know this play only because it's the play that preceded Kyle Shanahan's 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct, where he used a bad word that starts with the letter F that I can't say, so I'll just say forget. He said forget like four times in a row and then got penalized. Mm-hmm. And it was because he was mad because the officials didn't stop the game after Russell Wilson threw one of his
because
players'
shoe. Because of the shoe, I see.
And now, my hope was that Russell saw this shoe, realized who it came off of, and decided to try and gain a strategic advantage by throwing said shoe as far away from that player as he could. Like, hey, you need this, don't you? Go get it. Russell clarified yesterday that it wasn't quite like that. That he saw a shoe there, said, hey, is anybody missing a shoe? And then we've got hurry-up offense going, so I just threw it out of the way.
Here's the clip.
So what happened was the shoe was sitting there. I didn't know if it was our guy's shoe. I didn't know what was happening, but we were going no huddle, and we were moving pretty quick. So the problem was the shoe was right where, like, pretty much right where I was going to snap it area. Okay. You know, and so it was like, man, I got to throw this. I was like, anybody's shoe? And anybody, so I just tossed it, you know. So that's actually never happened before. I've never had that happen in a game. I've had towels drop down, you know mouthpieces or whatever. But it was a shoe, you know, it's got time to go. You know, the clock's running. You know, the refs ain't going to wait for that.
Well, you have to wait.
The refs?
I mean, you have
Hold
to
on.
Do that. Because...
Hold on.
No, he said the refs.
Okay. I thought he said the refs ain't going to wait for that.
Yeah. And normally I would think that's funny. But yeah, no, he did not refer to himself in the third person.
I'm just saying that's what you have. As actors, for example, you're told that if a prop falls on stage, like if you lose your hat or something, you pick it up as soon as possible. Because otherwise that draws focus away from the rest of the show.
Yes, the difference here being that you could actually have an advantage if you had a guy go run after his shoe.
There's that, too.
I went and looked and tried to find, because I remembered this happening, and it was an Eagles defensive back who, making a tackle, pulled Antonio Brown, a Pittsburgh receiver's shoe, off in the process of the tackle. Mm-hmm. So there was no mystery about where the shoe came from, who needed the shoe, or what it was. Mm-hmm. And he took it and he threw it as hard as he could toward the sidelines, which was what I was hoping that Russ
did. Well, now there's going to have to be an NFL meeting to adopt a rule on what constitutes a legitimate shoe throw.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I think this is what it is. If you lose your shoe in the field of play, anybody can do with said shoe whatever they want. If they want to destroy it, they can destroy it. Mm-hmm. If they want to throw it into the crowd, they can throw it into the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Tie your shoe.
Yep.
Double knots, yo.
Right? I got it. Lose your shoe, it's on you.
Now, about John Ryan, he has not found a job in the NFL, but he did find a job as the opening act for his wife, yeah?
Yes. So Sarah Colon is in town.
Yeah.
She's performing. I know that she's going to be on a couple different radio shows. And John is going to be the opening act. I'm really interested to see this. Stand-up comedy is exceptionally hard.
Yes.
I think anybody that...
Oh, yeah.
And Sarah is exceptionally good at it. Yeah. John could be, too, because John has a lot of courage. Like, he's not... Doesn't feel the commotion. I thought one of the ingredients of a really good stand-up comic is they have to be willing to deliberately make others kind of uncomfortable with their actions. And I think John's capable of doing that. It might be because he's Canadian, or maybe just because he's a weirdo. But John's got a pretty strong sense of self. I'm looking forward to hearing about how this goes.
Why has nobody picked him up?
It's a good question.
Is it?
Yeah, and it is, and it's probably because the margin of difference between punters that are out there and guys that have jobs is pretty narrow. And John's older, and maybe most teams were like, if somebody desperately needed a punter, he would absolutely be on a list. But I think all things being equal, they're like, do we want the guy who's a good punter for this year? Mm-hmm. Or do we want the guy that we think could be a good punter for the next 5 or 6 years?
Sure.
Sort of the tie going to younger players. But I don't know. I expected him to punt in the NFL this year.
Yeah.
He got signed by Buffalo in the preseason, and it didn't work out for him.
Aww.
Well, that's the leg up that he has. If he's no good at comedy, he can just punt.
I see what you did there.
Double meeting.
I like that.
You like it?
I like
Sports
that
Insider.
Lose your shoe, it's on you more.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer.
The Russ does.
Yeah, the Russ.
I love your dog.
Yeah, I don't believe you, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. This is one of the scariest stories I've heard. A Harvard professor is saying that French fries are so unhealthy that his recommended serving is 6. 6 fries! Most people have more than that under the front seat of their car. So we thought we'd call up Rebecca Scritchfield. She anchors the Body Kindness podcast and is a registered dietitian nutritionist, an RDN. So, let's start from the beginning. Are French fries intrinsically unhealthy?
No, there's no individual food that you can say, oh, yes, this is unhealthy. This is going to kill you. It's about eating patterns. So we either have healthy eating patterns that help energize us and help us do the things we love in life, or we have unhealthy eating patterns where they get in the way of our physical health or our mental health.
But French fries do have a lot of calories in them, right?
It all depends on what a lot is. We need a lot of calories to get through our days. They are definitely potatoes, whether they're sweet potatoes or white potatoes. And they are, for the most part, fried. If you're going to have them at a restaurant or fast food chain, they're going to be fried and not baked. And that changes their nutrition profile. But the idea that we should count 6 and somehow be satisfied off that, no. And it goes against human psychology. It's never going to work for people. I think it's ridiculous.
So this guy's from Harvard, so you cannot dismiss a study that comes out of, out of Harvard.
So he must know everything.
Well, that's what I figured. otherwise, how do you even get in? So, how should we take this kind of, because this is not the only time we've read stuff right. like this. So what do we do with it?
While I'm sure the Harvard professor intends to be helpful, we need to actually pause and look at the bigger picture. And it's the systems and structures that are at play that keep people reaching for fast food or quick energy, right? We work a lot. We have single parents. We have, lack of food access. We do get pleasure in abundance, right? But this idea that we should lay a rule and say only 6, that actually makes people want to reach for even more. We have this little rebel voice in our mind that's like, you can't control me. So I think we need to remember that our individual habits matter. And I would tell a person to stop and think about, well, what bothers you about the way you eat French fries in the first place, and start with your own personal solutions about what bothers you. Do you eat them too often or too much? Go there first, and then you could start to make an individual change. But when you blast out to all of America, stop at 6 fries, you're really not helping people find a positive and workable way where they might actually be able to change an eating pattern. So, for example, what other foods could they add in that might offset the French fries?
And you have been a proponent of not, of course, not body shaming, but not focusing so heavily on fat, but instead being in good shape.
It's self-care is what really matters, right? So I would ask a person, to take a look at their sleep. If you're getting enough sleep, you tend to have good daytime energy. You're likely to get a workout in. And if you're not regularly exercising, stopping and asking yourself, well, why isn't that happening? Are you only willing to go to the gym for really hard workouts? Or are you the kind of person that might need to have short 7 to 10 minute workouts at home? And so we all have barriers. We all have things we want to change, but we can't control our weight. We can control our choices. And that's where we want to start. What time am I going to bed? What am I going to put on my plate? How am I going to move today? And we got to start where we are and start to make small and incremental changes from a place of kindness and compassion, not shame. And that's how you're going to get your healthy habits. That's how you're going to, you know, cut back on fries if that's really what you need to do, because you actually stop and think, what is it that I need to take some meaningful action, and how is it going to energize me and inspire me to do so?
But every diet plan seems to be focused on weight. You just said don't focus on weight.
Yeah, no, I think that's why diets don't work. I mean, we now see it in research that most of the people who will initially lose weight on a diet regain that weight, and some even more. So it's like if a doctor said, here, take this pill, I guarantee you it won't work. In fact, it'll make your symptoms worse. You're probably not going to take that pill,
no,
right?
Probably not.
And yet, yeah, that's what diets do. And like the tobacco industry got you hooked on cigarettes, the diet industry has you hooked on diets. You get a dopamine reward just imagining yourself that slimmer new version of you. And it's bad for your psychology. It's bad for your emotions. It's bad for your social life. No one wants to be around a chronic diet or someone who's, you know, shaming themselves with every step they take. Oh, I have to make up for this with that. You know, mm-hmm. We don't want to be around that. But the problem is that we sell diets as the solution to better health. And what we need to do is think of health differently as a sense of well-being. I would challenge people more so to let go of the idea that the number on the scale says something about your health or your worth as a person.
Rebecca Scritchfield is the host of the Body Kindness Podcast. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.